Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We're getting started with our discussion. We're going to be going over the portion is called Shoftim, or Judges, and that goes from Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18, through chapter 21, verse 9. So, starting with Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18. You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God has given you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God has given you. You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. You shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar, which the Lord your God hates. Chapter 17. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God. If there is found in your midst, in any of your towns which the Lord your God has given you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, by transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun or the moon or any of the heavenly host, which I have not commanded, and if it is told you, and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Behold, if it is true, and the thing certain, that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out that man or that woman who has done this evil thing to your gates, that is, the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, and between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your courts, then you shall rise up and go up to the place where the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. You shall do according to the terms of the verdict, which they declare to you from that place which the Lord chooses, and you shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you. According to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you, to the right or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest, who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as a king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, You shall not multiply horses for yourself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Mitzrayim to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Now it shall come about, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. Chapter 18. The Levitical priests, the whole tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's offerings by fire and his portion. They shall have no inheritance among their countrymen. The Lord is their inheritance, as he promised them. Now this shall be the priest's due from the people, from those who offer a sacrifice, either an ox or a sheep, of which they shall give to the priest the shoulder and the two cheeks and the stomach. You shall give him the first fruits of your grain, your new wine and your oil, and the first shearing of your sheep. For the Lord your God has chosen him and his sons from all your tribes to stand and serve in the name of the Lord forever. Now, if a Levite comes from any of your towns throughout Israel where he resides, and comes whenever he desires to the place the Lord chooses, then he shall serve in the name of the Lord his God, like all his fellow Levites who stand before the Lord. They shall eat equal portions, except what they receive from the sale of their father's estates. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the detestable things of the nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, one who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who casts a spell, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord. And because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. For those nations which you shall dispossess, listen to those who practice witchcraft and to diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. This is according to all that you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see this great fire any more, or I will die. The Lord said to me, they have spoken well. I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. But the prophet who speaks a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. You may say in your heart, how will we know the word which the Lord has not? How will we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about or come true, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. Chapter 19. When the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God gives you, and you dispossess them, and settle in their cities and in their houses, You shall set aside three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you to possess. You shall prepare the roads for yourself and divide into three parts the territory of your land, which the Lord your God will give you as a possession, so that any manslayer may flee there. Now this is the case of the manslayer who may flee there and live. When he kills his friend unintentionally, not hating him previously, as when a man goes into the forest with his friend to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe, cut down the tree, and the iron head slips off the handle and strikes his friend so that he dies, he may flee to one of these cities and live. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue the manslayer in the heat of his anger and overtake him, because the way is long, and take his life, though he is not deserving of death, since he had not hated him previously. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall set aside three cities for yourself. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which he promised to give your fathers, if you carefully observe all this commandment which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk with him always, then you shall add three more cities for yourself besides these three. So innocent blood will not be shed in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, and blood guiltness be on you. But if there is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him, and rises up against him and strikes him, so that he dies and he flees to one of these cities, then the elders of his city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood, that he may die. You shall not pity him, but you shall purge the blood of the innocent from Israel, that it may go well with you. You shall not move your neighbor's boundary mark, which the ancestors have set, in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God gives you to possess. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses shall a matter be confirmed. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who will be in office in those days. The judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he has intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid, and will never again do such a thing among you. Thus you shall show no pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Chapter 20. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, who has brought you up from the land of Mitzrayim, is with you. When you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people. He shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted. Do not be afraid or panic or tremble before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." The officers also shall speak to the people, saying, "Who is the man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise he might die in battle, and another man would dedicate it. Who is the man who has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use its fruit? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise he might die in the battle, and another man would begin to use its fruit. And who is the man that is engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise he might die in the battle, and another man would marry her." Then the officers shall speak further to the people and say, "Who is the man who is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brother's heart melt like his heart." When the officers have finished speaking to the people, They shall appoint commanders of armies at the head of the people. When you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. If it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourself. And you shall use the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are far from you, which are not of the cities of the nations nearby. Only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God has given you as inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hivite, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite, all the Lord your God has commanded you, so that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. When you besiege a city a long time to make war against it in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat from them, and you shall not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man that it should be besieged by you? Only the trees which you know are not fruit trees you shall destroy and cut down, that you may construct siege works against the city that is making war with you until it falls. Chapter 21. If a slain person is found lying in the open country in the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess, and it is not known who struck him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance to the cities which are around the slain one. It shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, that is, the elders of that city, shall take a heifer of the herd which has not been worked and which has not pulled in a yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in the name of the Lord, and every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. All the elders of that city, which is nearest to the slain man, shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and shall answer and say, "Our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel, and the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them. So you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst, when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord." Okay, well, that is the passage that we're going over today. Before we get started too much further, are there any questions to start out with? Yes?
I have a comment. Trees, Asherim, Christmas tree. When someone conquers another nation, they're not allowed to chop down the trees. Trees are precious for fruit and food and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just a comment.
Okay.
I think it's interesting, all those caveats in terms of what kind of men can serve in a standing army or something like that. If he's doing this, no. If he's doing that, no. It kind of got me thinking about how if you disqualify recently married or engaged men, you disqualify farmers, you know, with new fields and this kind of thing. It makes you a lot more careful about when you would consider going to war if you don't have a lot of men to fight it.
Okay. Observation there. One of the things, I guess, to remember is something that it notes kind of in passing in that one is that there is not a, you know, the one who is actually fighting the battle is really the Lord in that case. The people who are fighting are kind of incidental.
A couple of things I wanted to ask. You made some comments in my Bible. I don't know if it was there. It was you named body parts. I think you said cheek and your stomach and I dropped by the time I got the pen and shoulder. So those mean something. And then you said something about a prophet. When a prophet speaks and it doesn't come to pass, when does it? What's the length? Ever? If we hear about it. When's the prophets, if it doesn't come to pass, I want to know the timeline.
Is there a statute of limitations
right.
in prophecy?
Absolutely. And it says, cut those trees down, the trees that are not for food. So I want you to go elaborate on that.
About making siege works?
Making it worse? Or
siege works, to do a siege, most likely to either build towers to go over the walls or ladders to go over the walls or battering ram to go through the gate. Those are kind of what they are, typical siege works that were done in quite throughout a lot long period of history. Yeah, you don't do that with food trees. Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of those things that sometimes I depart from that on. A number of levels, but I don't subscribe to the Rashi view that behind everything in there is some sort of symbolic meaning. Things that are meant to be symbolic perhaps should be perused for symbolic meaning sacrifices are stand-ins for people, so thus God is trying to tell something through the symbols of offerings, something deeper. However, you know, is two people walking down a road something more than two people walking down a road? Some people read a lot more into things, and you know, parables are one place where people start reading into every little detail something different. So one of those things is to first look at what's actually there, then actually step back and say, well, is there something more going on here than that? The words, okay, go back and read the laws. To leave the trees there. Okay, well, it'd be something to take a look at there. So, anybody notice, for all these details, what is the most important thing if you ever come out of this whole passage with only two thoughts? What are they? Two or three witnesses, okay, that's about judiciary. About the ways that you should determine whether something is true or not, to how to make proper judgments of things. And what's the other one? Who is a real prophet and who is the prophet, this prophet who is said to be coming? So if you don't get anything out of this whole passage, those are the two really main things to look at in this. So we'll zero down into some details, but if we go off into the weeds too much and miss those two primary things in here, we'll really miss a lot in this passage.
Sorry, just going off your prophet, is this like prophetic for Jesus? Is that what you, the prophet?
Yes.
Okay.
So one of those things where you see in the Gospels and they are asking, you know, Yochanan or called John the Baptist, there, are you the prophet? The prophet meant something and really goes back to this particular passage, this one who's coming up. Like Moshe. And when you think throughout Israel's history, there's really, you know, some, when you think of like the greatest, the top prophets throughout Israel's history, you can really think of the big ones there, like Eliyahu. We were just singing about Eliyahu earlier. Think of, you know, Yeshayahu or Isaiah, Yirmiyahu or Jeremiah, these really big, big prophets in there. But the biggest of them all, when you compare them and stack them up, was the prophet who was coming. It says there was this realization that yes, there have been some great prophets who came along, even ones who called down fire from heaven, yet there was still this great prophet who was going to come that would be distinctive among all the other ones. So any other thoughts before we get going further too much. Yes.
I just thought it was interesting that when, if you find someone slain out in the field, you're supposed to go and take a marker and
figure out who's responsible. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The closest city that's quote responsible unquote for this. We'll be getting to that in a bit, but one of the things to think about first off is that life is so precious that even if there's quote no one quote responsible for a death, someone has to take responsibility for it. Even basically as in absentia, you just basically have to make an atonement for something. And quite significant when we look at that, you might think about heifer. Oh, I think I remember something about that. Numbers, you know, 19 and stuff about the red heifer. That should get your brain started about what that's all about.
Well, in some ways, we even do that today. In some ways, we don't go around, we don't sacrifice an animal, but we have a concept of jurisdiction. So, like, even nowadays, if a body were to wash up on shore, or if somebody found a hollow, like a shallow grave or something like that, where that body is found is the jurisdiction that's required to investigate that situation. So we even do that now. What is the nearest county or the nearest city or whatever that has jurisdiction to investigate that? We do that now. It's not so obscure.
Yeah, well, certain boundaries and responsibility of the government within those boundaries to take care of matters such as government and also law enforcement. So a little bit of a where are we as we go through this, because one of the things we looked at the beginning of Devarim or Deuteronomy is what some of the big themes are throughout this entire book. It may look like just a hodgepodge mess of stuff that's unrelated, but one of the things to really look at is that these are parts of a big message. This whole thing, pretty much most of the entire book of Devarim, is like a farewell address, and it's coming through. You know, if you were to have like the red letter edition of the Bible, if you were to have, I don't know, blue letter edition where the words of Moses, most of this would be blue. Most of Deuteronomy would be this address from Moshe as they're getting ready to go into the land. And Deuteronomy is the Greek word for basically second telling, second account. So this is for that second generation that's getting ready to go in, as like, okay, you're going in. This is the legacy that you have, that God has taken you this far. This is where you come from. This is where you're going. And when you get there, remember why you're there, why you're going there, and what to do when you are in the land. So in this passage that we're looking at specifically is in this, you could call this the second address, which from Moshe, which goes on from chapter 4 all the way through chapter 28, so nearly to the end. And from chapter 6 through chapter 26 is what you could say is kind of an elaboration and explanation of what the 10 words or the 10 commandments that we've seen over there in Exodus chapter 20. But in Deuteronomy chapter 5, they're reiterated again. And then in chapter 6 going forward, it really kind of explains what these are about. So that if you had a question, well, what does it mean really about blasphemy? What is blasphemy? What does that mean? What does, you know, having a idolatry and foreign gods, or having God first, what does that all mean? And we've looked about at those passages going up to this point. Our last one that we went through was really kind of building upon the fourth commandment about the seventh-day Sabbath, but the seventh-day Sabbath being kind of like the king or the queen, if you like, of all of the appointed times, all of God's appointments with mankind, that being the pinnacle. Because when you see in Revelation, there in chapter 13 and such, one of the final messages for all of mankind is, remember the one who made everything. So the memorial of the Creator, all the way from, you know, Genesis chapter 2, That memorial is hugely important, and as is revealed there in Revelation, it is hugely important, especially for some of the final chapters of Earth's history. And as we've seen for at least 150 years of Earth's history, there's been a prevailing effort, and actually really for, I guess, probably closer to 250 years, this really asserted effort among folks to stamp out the God of Israel as the creator, the one who brought everything about, and to assert, bring forth the hypothesis that things came about on their own. I mean, I think it might be something that only started in the middle part or the latter half of the 19th century, but really, it goes all the way back into the 1700s, and where you start seeing a lot of that coming forward. So, when we look at this passage that we're in today, we're really going to be going over kind of the fifth and sixth devar, or words, statements, these commandments, the fifth commandment, the sixth commandment. So, really looking over the fifth commandment, you know, honor your father and your mother, that your days will go well for you on the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So, that being the fifth one, and the sixth one, depending on your translation of that from Exodus 20, it says, you shall not kill or you shall not murder. So, be looking at, you know, what is it that it's actually referring to in that one. So, it's kind of where things are divided up, and subject matter on the fifth devar would be kind of going from the beginning part of our passage through chapter 18. So, really the parts that we're looking at in 16 through 18, be covering that, and chapter 19 through where we ended in chapter 21, covering that second part of the question of you shall not murder. And some of the things that we cover with under that, the sixth commandment, the cities of refuge and what witnesses, rules of war, and that last part that we just talked about with atoning for an unsolved crime. Yeah. So, we'll begin with the discussion over the fifth devar, or the fifth commandment, with our section starting in Deuteronomy 16, verse 18. It starts out there, right, with the first two verses of that, verses 18 and 20, talking about appointing judges, appointing these shoftim in every town. Every town is going to have at least some sort of a court system. Now, it might kind of jog your memory, and we're going back through Exodus chapter 18. Remember where Moshe's father-in-law, Yitro, came in from Midian and said, my dad always calls him the first recorded management consultant in Earth's history. He says, you're overworking yourself. Don't take on every case yourself. Delegate. So, talking about setting up a really what amounts to a court system, or at least an administrative system, from, it talks about tens, hundreds, thousands, all the way up. So that you have, instead of Moshe solving every little thing from, you know, stop touching me, to all the way up to big waiters of murder, no, these things will then get delegated down to the family level, where you've got people who are basically, maybe have groups of families or something like that, to solve these matters. And then as the cases get more severe, they keep getting bumped up one level to the next to higher courts as they move along. So, some people might take issue with what ended up in later on in Israel's history with how that came about, but there is some biblical form for it in the Mishnah, which is some of the first traditions that get written down in the tractate Sanhedrin. You might remember that word there, talking about the Sanhedrin, or the high court, the supreme court of Israel at the time. In the first section, it kind of talks about some of these levels of the court system, from the Beit Din, which is the base level, up to the Beit Din HaKatan. And so Beit is house, Din is judge or judgment, and Katan is referring to something that's small. So then you have the Beit Din HaGadol, which is Gadol is great or huge, And so that is the big court, the big Sanhedrin. So you had like the Beit Din, then the Beit Din HaKatan, and then the Beit Din HaGadol, which is what commonly is just referred to as Sanhedrin. But in a lot of writings, it's called the Great Sanhedrin, because they had the Sanhedrin, you know, HaKatan or HaKatana. They're referred to as the lesser one down. So how these get usually divided, it's talked about by tradition, is that for the basically each city, so when it talks about set up in your cities these judges, that's kind of like where the Beit Din level is. And traditionally it's like the, as it mentions in here, two or three witnesses, so they appointed three judges. There had to at least be three judges there to determine these cases on like a city-wide level. And by tradition, they did not cover any sort of death penalty things. Anything like that got kicked up to the next level, which was the Beit Din HaKatan. And that was either over a big, quote, big city, somebody over like 200 people, or a group of cities, basically one, at least one per tribe or one per major city of a tribe. You kick those things up to that level. And then anything beyond that, stuff that was like a national scale, you kick that even up to the one that was located in the place where God put his name. So Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, that would be the Beit Din HaGadol, which would have 71 members. And that is thought to have come there from Numbers chapter 11. Remember where the Creator has lunch with Moshe and the 70 elders. He says, pick out these 70 leaders. So that's where that came from. And the idea of the odd numbers is that to never have a deadlock, so that you at least have some sort of a decision made at every court level.
So I have a question. I'm not really sure the whole meaning of the fifth commandment when it says honor your father and mother. I know it has to do something with taking care of them and money and properties or their welfare or something. Could you elaborate on that a little more?
Okay. So actually what this section that we're looking at from 16 through 18 is talking about. So these subjects talking about judges, talking about the courts, and mentions the king, and then finally about really the priests and the Levites, and then the true and the false prophet, and talking about the great prophet. So if you were like, you know, on those great nasty SAT or ACT tests where they say, what do all these things have to do with each other? You're like, okay, what do all of those things have to do with each other? About judges, courts, the king, the priests and the Levites, the true and false prophets. What do all those things have to do with each other? Government. Well, what does government have to do? What is government? Rules and regulations. Order. What is the Achilles heel, the fatal flaw of government? People, okay. Overextension. Well, it is, no one wants to actually follow it.
Right.
Which gets back to the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother. That is what this all has to do with it, is that you actually have to respect your father and your mother. So when it talks about honoring them, one of the things in there is about respecting your father and your mother. That's where all of these things come in. So when you talk about the judges, you're respecting their judgment. The courts of law, you're respecting their rulings. The king, you're respecting the king as your leader going forward. The priests and the Levites, you're respecting them as God's servants. So what they're doing, you know, taking your offering in, representing you into the presence of God. And then the true and the false prophets, that they are actually speaking the words of God. Now, just as we somebody mentioned here, one of the fatal flaws of government is overextension of government and people and the frailties of people. So at every one of these stages, you could say, ah, yeah, but, well, yeah, that's the one of the key issues is. And that's really, and you want to break down all of the history books that we have in the Bible, plus all the prophets, plus all of the, quote, New Testament, unquote, the apostolic writings, That is what they're all about, is the yeah, but. The human factor of, did God really say, da-da-da-da-da-da? Do we really want to go along with this? Did God really say that? Did he really send this person? Did he really do this? Did he really do that? And second-guessing, bringing in, you know, one of the things that's mentioned in the passage here is bringing in blemished offerings. That's a smack in the face for God, and some of the things that's mentioned specifically as you open up there in Isaiah chapter 1 and kind of gets going as to why the Creator gets so angry at the people is that, who are you trying to fool? You think God is fooled by this you're bringing in, and he doesn't know what you're doing and has no idea what's going on in your heart? So as this passage starts of this elucidation, this explaining of the Ten Commandments, it starts in chapter 6, which is where we get the Shema that we, every week, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. God is not fooled where your heart is. So when we talk about the idea of the new covenant, and it's explained there in Jeremiah 31 and Ezekiel 36, that foretelling of this coming really goes back to where it was in the Torah as it started. The laws of God have to come out of what your heart is doing, not totally just out of your head. Because if it just is all up in your head, then you can be teetering on the edge of hypocrisy, being, you know, just what you say and what you're talking about versus what you're actually doing and how you live your life. Yeah, the what we call today the lifestyle. If the words of God are not actually in your heart and coming out of your heart, the way that you react to things, the way you feel about things, then you have a problem. Because when you think about the Sermon on the Mount there in Matthew chapter 5 through 7, that's really about, a lot of people get distracted by the, you know, you've heard it said, but I tell you, you've heard it said, but I tell you. One way that you could really paraphrase that is, the law says this, you know, you, and one of those things actually applies to the passage we're looking at today, is honor your father and your mother. And then it goes on to the thing about the offerings, and you know, you will bring your offering there. But it also adds a part about, you know, if you bring an offering to the temple, that will take the place of honoring your father and your mother. So one of those things that the correction is that, well, who are you really fooling with this? You're bringing this to the altar. Who's what? It's supposed to be the place where God is interacting with mankind, and you don't think that God noticed that you're not respecting your parents and taking care of your parents and saying that, oh, I'm going to bring this to God and not take care of my parents, not fulfill that obligation. So then God's not going to notice that. That's one of those cases where you could say one of the things that God is really talking about is take the you shall do this to you will want to do this. You will want to do that. You know, you will want to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And you're like, well, wow, how does that happen? And that's a lot of what the prophets and the apostles get at. There has to be a transformation of what's going on inside of us, that want to changes from have to. And that's something that, you know, we hope happens from the time you're a child to going up as an adult. All those things that your parents say, you know, you need to do this. You have to do this. To, wow, that's great. I want to do this. And that becomes actually a part of who you are in the future. So, yes, question. Aha.
Religious and transforming it into a relationship. So changing the, just like you said, making it a metric, like I'm going to just do this to look like I'm to the true relationship where the heart is involved.
Mm. Yes, and that's actually, it's really interesting you get at that of changing the words into the relationship, something that's coming out of you. One of the things we'll be getting to here shortly when we talk about the prophets and the true and the false prophets is really what a prophet actually is and what they're actually doing. But first, one thing, as we're talking about the judicial system and the levels of the judges going up, one of the things that, recall, we talked about this kind of in Numbers as we were going through there, talking about the leadership and such, but good to reiterate it again. In the apostolic writings, you have the descriptions of the levels of leaders throughout the body of Messiah. Yeah, they're commonly called them like deacons, elders, overseers, or bishops, and finally the either the Jerusalem Council or the apostles themselves, the 12. So those things are described there. One of the things you see about the deacons specifically, and the diaconia, which is where we get the word deacon from, it just simply means minister or someone who, a servant, someone who puts things into action. They are the action people. So you see them kind of described in Acts 14:23 and Titus 1:5. But specifically you see that in the beginning verses of Acts chapter 6 when you get the great deacons were first inaugurated and Stephen being among the ones specifically mentioned there. And one of the things that they were tasked with specifically is taking care of the needs of the congregation because they're talking about there's food that needed to get out to people who needed food. And it mentions in there specifically that so that the apostles can be devoted to prayer and, interestingly enough, the diaconia of the word. So it's not like the apostles were not deacons. The apostles were deacons too, but just deacons with a different mandate. They were deacons specifically serving the word. The quote deacons were the ones that took care of the needs of the congregation specifically. And overseers be ones that were, you could say, over a certain area or certain groups of congregations and such moving up. So not exactly one-to-one with this level of the judges, but they were looking over the matters that were happening in the congregations. And you see, like in 1st and 2nd Corinthians, with that issue of the member of the congregation who was involved in a pretty illicit relationship, that was kind of a matter that you would say is really what you see there is like a Beit Din sort of approach to that, where they had to make a decision of what to do with this guy. And when you're looking at the situation, well, that was, if it was adjudicated as such, it would be really adultery. So you could say, well, wouldn't that be something, a matter that would be kicked up to a death penalty level? Well, there was not a level of a court in that area. So what they did was pretty much equivalent to that. And they said, cast him out of the congregation. So what we use the big 50-cent word today, excommunication, was kind of a bit of a form of that cutting off of the person from the congregation. And we see in 2 Corinthians, the good news of that is that that seemed to, thank God, have the effect that was needed to wake the guy up and say, ah, wow, that's not the direction I need to go. So that, thank God, is the approach that should be taken with this, is that for the reconciliation of not only the person involved, but also the congregation involved. Because you remember in 1 and 2 Corinthians, one of the issues of that was their pride over this guy and the way he was living. They were had a lot of pride in their tolerance of the situation. Like, we are having a lot of grace in this. Look at how great of people we are in holding to this. And Paul's was saying, you know, what are you doing? Yes, grace covers our old life, but that's our old life. God is wanting us to be a new creation, to move forward, not remain the same people we were before, you know, continually getting whitewashed all the time with the big grace brush. The grace brush is to make the, quote, old man die, to go away, so that the new man goes off and into, quote, the land, which is really what a lot of Deuteronomy is getting at, is we got to leave the old man there in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. Got to leave that old man there. The new man is going into the land. And that new man going into the land has got to be acting quite a bit differently. So internalizing a lot of the principles that you see there in how do you respect authority in all kinds of different levels? How do you respect it all the way from your family, all the way on up to the prophet? One of the things that we can really get from this discussion that we have about the different levels of courts is, and it's a quote, you may have heard it, it's somewhat apocryphal, meaning that not necessarily totally attributable to George Washington, but it's been attributed to him for a long time. But whoever said it was incredibly, you could say, prescient or be able to look forward and have a lot of insight and wisdom into this. Government is not reason, it's not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful matter. Never for a moment should be left to irresponsible action. That really just sums up all levels of what we're looking at here, is that all these levels that we're talking about, from parents through to judges, to the king, to the priests, to the prophets, to the prophet, all these levels cannot be something that is taken flippantly or taken without a huge level of respect for the office that you're going through, which is, as we get into some of these details of these instructions given at these various levels, you can see as to how much care is supposed to be taken at these different levels. Any thoughts further on this before we move forward? Well, we're talking about the idea of a court system, moving forward with the court system. Yes.
I just know that right now, the government is respecting their government, and it has, you know, made them not trust them. So therefore, they feel like this mentality of I have to get mine. Being well, dishonest. I know that's not right for us, but I mean.
Yeah, one of those things is how to delicately put it, but the common saying of stuff goes downhill, it truly applies here. And the top of the hill is not the government. The government is the bottom of the hill with the bucket. And that's where all of the things throughout all the levels that we're talking about flow. So if a king is corrupt, is it just, oh, the king is corrupt. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the king is corrupt. However, one of those things about how the king gets there and the king being supported and staying there, that's also something that flows up from the bottom. And the various levels of judges and the various levels of the prophets, all these things, you know, flow up from the individual level to the top level. So when you're seeing these things that come in later on in Israel's history, was it just because someone at the top just suddenly snapped and everything went off course? No. The only reason it was able to keep going off course was because as you look down, it kind of is an offhand mention in Judges. It talks about, well, everybody was doing what was right in his own eyes. Now, you can look at that in two different ways. You can say, okay, well, it's great that everyone was self-governed. But the problem is that if people are not self-governed, what is right in their own eyes is up to a whole lot of interpretation. Because if it's not really based on what God's instructions are, then look out. And as you see, as things spilled out throughout the book of Judges and forward, it seems like more of the latter, that people were paying less and less attention to what God had to say and more attention to what other people had to say and other people saying what God said. And then finally, to the point where, oh, God said something, and finding it in the back room somewhere and having to dust it off. Wouldn't be in the mess we're if we're all self-governed. Well, see, that's... Yeah, and see, that's one of those challenges, you know, when you go up from your personal level all the way up, is that the more you are self-governed, the less you may have to be governed. And you think about it in your own job. If you are known to be a person who does what they're supposed to do, doesn't have to be minded all the time. You know, you may have a micromanager boss who wants to see what you're doing all the time, but if you have somebody who's wise and checks in and says, hey, he's doing what he's supposed to do, things get done on time, I don't have to keep minding him all the time, you know, he's not off doing something else, what he's supposed to be working, that kind of stuff, you get known to be that, and you see that in Yosef's life. His overseer, his boss, said, hey, he's an incredibly trustworthy person. You know, the things they were hearing about where he came from and his family and this and that. Hey, you know, there's something to that God of Israel that he keeps talking about. And thus, he kept getting greater and greater and greater authority because people could trust him moving forward. And really, that trust, faith, that you have in the various levels of authority is really what's at issue of this. You know, those who are trustworthy can be worthy of trust. But you also see examples from the word that you also pay respect to people even if they may be not worthy of respect. A couple of examples of that would be, you know, David, with Saul. I mean, Shaul was a nasty guy, kept coming after him, trying to kill him all the time. Yet, one of the things that Dawid said when he finally had him, I cannot take up my hand against the Lord's anointed. Until that changed, it was hands off. That wasn't something he was going to touch. You see that also with, you know, the prophet Daniel. If you've ever read any history about Nebuchadnezzar, who he was serving with, and the Darius and the other leaders that came after in Babylon and Persia, they were not pussycats, and they were not a nice people whatsoever. Yet, that was something that they paid respect to. And that respect, people noticed. And they also noticed that, you could say that the velvet hammer of God's power being expressed there. Because Nebuchadnezzar thought he was in charge and doing something great, and realized, you could see that perhaps he came to that realization of what God said through the prophets, I set up nations and take them down. You see a little bit of that with what Nebuchadnezzar says there in the book of Daniel that's attributed to him. He finally comes to that realization as, okay, yeah, you can see he kind of goes off course a little bit later, but at that one point in time, he came to the realization is that, okay, yeah, I am wearing the crown, but there could be one who put this crown on my head. So that is a bit of a realization, is really what's behind all of what we're seeing in this passage, is that we should always be cognizant of the one who put our, quote, crowns on our head. Not that we're so worthy of our crown, is that someone has made us worthy of that crown and makes us worthy to continue wearing the crown. That's one of those great things when you look forward and you talk about in Revelation about giving these crowns and being there reigning with God. That's a part of a training process. for us, you know, think of how we grew up. Did we just kind of flip the switch and go from being completely incorrigible to being trustworthy and obedient? No, that took a lot of that trust thing over time. The trust that the obedience and the trustworthiness is actually the better way to go. It's actually, in long term, the right way to go. It's like when you see, and talking about Daniel again, with his friends, and they said, you know, even if he kills us, even if we die in this furnace, yet we'll continue to serve him. Because perhaps this is the way we're supposed to go. But we're not going to give up on him just because your sword is at our throat, even though God gave you that sword. So that's one of those harsh things to approach in this, is these, as we've talked about all these levels of authority going on up, there may be some people in those levels that are not worthy of respect. But we have to be extremely, extremely careful in saying you're not worthy of respect. Because you see the example of the apostles in the book of Acts. You know, they were, you could say, well, they had no choice but to pay deference to the Sanhedrin when they got hauled in. But they gave deference up to only that point, we must follow God and not man. But up to that point, the authority was there. The Apostle Paul was saying, even when the high priest was acting like a, you know, so-and-so, he still said, he's in that role, I have to respect that role. That's the position he's put in. May not be acting worthy of the office, but that is the position he's in at that given time. So that's one of those things when we get building up to the great kind of pinnacle of this passage with the discussion of the prophet there in chapter 18. When the prophet comes, and the prophet is not what you might expect the prophet to be, even though God has given lots of indications that yes, it is, then what are you going to follow? Your expectations or God's, you know, you could say his invitation that he's given out 1,000 years before. So the passage we're going to be looking at and focus on greater detail is here in Deuteronomy 18. It starts out there talking with the Levites and the tribe of Levi there does not inherit the land. We've talked about this and in times past, like especially in Numbers, where the places where each tribe was designated out and the Levites were there spread among them. And among the tasks that they had, you know, both historically and specifically written here in Scripture, is that they are the ones who serve God as part of the, you could say, like, they are the State Department of God. They are the ones that interact between the kingdom of heaven and mankind. They are the ones that are specifically involved with him. They are operating the, quote, embassy of God, which is the tabernacle, the temple. So they are the ones that are basically left to these embassies around there, and they're given these towns, and they're spread out through all of the tribes. Each tribe is going to have these Levite cities, and they're spread out, and they serve functions. Over time, you see them function as teachers, as they're supposed to be learning about what God says, and then communicating that out to the people. But also, you see the roles that they serve in later on in time. They become the ones who provide some, you'd say, tending sheep for the people who are coming in and buying sheep. That's much later on in Israel's history when you had the diaspora and people coming in on pilgrimages and buying sheep, doves, whatever. A number of times you had the Levites there out tending these sheep and providing something for the people coming in from all kinds of hill and dale of the both the Roman and the Parthian empires at that time to buy and present as offerings. So one of the things that you see there specifically is that they are meant to inherit what God is getting via these offerings. These offerings come in from the people, and a portion of them, and I mentioned the various portions of some of the animals and these and the sacrifices and offerings of grain and whatnot that were specifically going to the Levites. So when you look at the things that God provides, it's like, I was born, say for example, you're born into the tribe of Levi. And it's like, crud. I don't get this kind of inheritance, you know, in the city, okay, yeah, but I don't get inheritance otherwise. You know, I am relegated to this particular job, and if I'm in of the family of Levi, but not the family of Aaron, then I can tend sheep or whatever, but I can't go serve in the tabernacle. Well, shake your fist at heaven. Say, I was born in Levi, but not in the family of Aaron. So thus I can't be a priest. Well, what if you're in the tribe of Benjamin or Reuben or whatever? And then you look at Levi and say, I wasn't born in that one. So I don't get gifts given to me that come through the tabernacle. And shake your fist at the sky and say, I wasn't born in Levi. Well, okay, we can keep going on and on and on with this. Well, by saying that I wasn't this or I wasn't that, but where is it the place that we are specifically given and the task that we are specifically given to do? We're talking about like of these particular things. The Apostle Paul says some are appointed to be apostles and teachers and overseers and deacons and prophets and whatever. Well, what if our task isn't what we want it to be? Do we just say, shake our fist at God and say, oh, that's not what I wanted to do. But wow, you got a gift to do something else. Do you follow along with what you're given to do? Or do you just keep getting angry that you don't get what you want your task to be? So we get the beginning part of Deuteronomy chapter 18 is talking about the Levites, what they're to do, what gifts they get, what their apportionment is. And so you have that level of priests. These are the representatives of God. Then it talks about prophets. And prophets now is a different classification of God. It's really kind of an interesting thing when you think of prophets, because you think of priesthood, oh, okay, these are the ones, they're, you think of maybe analogous to our embassies, you've got an ambassador or a consul general who sits there in a particular city or in a consulate. And they are the representatives, and things just come right down from the head of state down to the ambassador through the consul generals to the consulates and out the door. And so people figure out what's going on. So you think about, well, the priesthood. Things come from God to the high priest, then to the priests, then out perhaps the Levites as they become teachers and such, and out it goes. Yet, then you've got these prophets. Well, that seems odd. It doesn't seem like orderly, where you got prophets who pop up and say, God told me to say this. God showed me this. God gave me this message, and here it is. God said, this is going to happen. God said, you know, what you want to do is not going to happen. And that seems like, whoop, just completely a strange thing of a shift of the order out of order, where it seems a little bit chaotic. Well, perhaps that's one of those things where we can get a clue that, number one, perhaps things aren't going to progress in messages from God how we think they are. So we should pay attention to what God is actually saying. But in a sense, prophets are there to, yeah, maybe a bit controversial. They're there to confuse us. They're there to confuse us. They're to make us think, did God really say? Because one of the messages coming through, You talk about all these tests that you have to put a prophet through. That's challenging. Because you're always at that, the back of your mind, what if he's a false prophet? What if he's this? What if he's that? We always say we go back and check the word, but you have to go back and check the word. You have to compare what they're saying, what they're pointing you toward with what the word says. So in a sense, they're like parables. They're like walking parables. They're meant there to, I guess, confuse you. But confuse you for your good, to push you, to make you stretch, to push you forward to... Yes, we have a comment down here.
Making me think in the test. So if the Holy Spirit didn't come until after Jesus' ascension, how did they have discernment? How would they... I mean, was it literally just the word that they had, or...
Well, one of the things that we're talking about the with Pentecost that we see there in Acts chapter 2 is actually kind of like that situation part 2. The first part of that was really there at the mountain. We mentioned earlier about the 70 elders and Moshe having lunch with God. Well, that particular passage refers to a situation where the Spirit of God came down. These people, they said they were prophesying in the town. There was these two people that were in the camp and they were prophesying. That was a specific, you're talking about outpouring of the Spirit of God poured out on them. That was really an example of that. So when you see that in Acts chapter 2 of the Spirit coming with power and people were able to hear these words from whatever country they came from in their own native language, that was another outpouring, kind of a, I guess, a really special sign that God is doing something here. A lot of people got confused, were these people drunk or whatever, but, you know, which seems odd that drunk people are not usually coherent. So to be able to be getting very coherent messages and such seems a bit odd, but it becomes quite a bit out of joint from what you're expecting. You see prophets in the apostolic scriptures, they'll pop up. Like the guy came up to Paul and, you know, bound his hands and said, this is what's going to happen to you. It's like, whoa, that just, it seems like it's a curveball that's just coming out of there. And it's supposed to be a curveball. The parables are curveballs. Those people who were paying attention got what Messiah was saying when he told the parables. They understood that he was talking to them because it stretched them. Because a lot of, you know, rabbinical literature is full of parables and such. And those parables are meant to take you farther, to stretch you further, to make you go beyond what you think you know and stretch you to really understand what is really being said. You know, Prophet Jeremiah used a lot of those parables. And a lot of those end up being some pretty grueling, you could say, today we call it performance art, but it was not art. It was performance message, performance prophecy is really what that was. Laying on your side and laying on your other side and broken pots and stuff like that to really stretch you to see what is actually going on more than what we think is going on. It also is a little bit of a drop into our what we think is reality to show us, hey, there's something bigger than our what we think is reality going on here. There is that spiritual realm that really is in control of the situation and really pointing us forward and where we're going. So we got the, and back here into Deuteronomy chapter 18, we've seen the priesthood. Now we're getting to these prophets. And as it starts out here in really starting in, it's kind of interesting as it goes, it talks about the priests, okay, and then verse 9 goes on about all these things that you're not supposed to follow after. So we talk about priests, these are the representatives of God. Then it goes into, these are the types of people and their practices that you are not to follow. Now, what do all of those things have in common, whether you're talking about, you know, burning child in fire as a sacrifice, a diviner, a witch, one who interprets omens, you might call call that a seer or what is that? Abominations, you know, things that stink in God's nose. But why? Why do they stink? Okay, you say they're evil, they're in a bad thing, but why are they bad? Okay, why are they adultery? Okay, that's really getting, you know, you're looking to those things versus looking toward God. Yes?
They distract from the word of God, and they make gods out of creation itself sometimes, but it twists, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the God you're supposed to listen to and serve. But these acts make it seem like you don't need him to get what you want to get. It's like a twist.
You don't have to go through his channels.
Right.
Yeah, and you see that it really goes back to the whole tree of the knowledge of good and bad in the garden, is that, oh, instead of going to the source of all knowledge, you're going to go to a tree to be your source of knowledge. Specifically, a place where God says, don't go there. Don't go to this tree, the knowledge of good and evil. Don't go there. You think, well, okay, don't go there. Well, what should then be your other thought? Well, where do I go for the knowledge of good and evil? Well, that should then bring the answer. Well, you go to the Creator for the knowledge of what's good and what's bad, versus trying to go somewhere else. And that, we see that really lived out specifically in you know, King or Prince Shaul's life, where he had gone so far off the track, and then God stopped talking to him, and couldn't understand why God was not talking to him. He really wanted to hear God's voice, but I don't know if he was like had liked to, you know, inflict punishment upon himself, but it's like he didn't want to hear what God had to say, yet was very distressed when he didn't hear it anymore. And that should actually be, I don't know, very sobering and frightening if you think about it, that you are heading so far away from where God is going, yet God is actually talking to you. And obviously, Shaul, I guess at some point, must have really understood that God actually was talking to him, because when he stopped talking, he knew it. And that kind of pain within him just started growing deeper and deeper and deeper till he went really off the rails and then started to go to one of the folks specifically on this list, one who had contact with the dead. So very odd that you would say, God is not talking to me, not personally, not through a prophet, so I'm going to go to a necromancer, someone who talks with the dead, to now bring up a prophet who is dead, who talked with God, to now tell me what was supposedly the real deal here. So that's one of those cases of a real example, besides the whole Adam and Eve and the fall thing, which should have kind of really underscored that, but another underscoring of that we should be going to the source of knowledge and the source of life versus trying to go through some other channel, because, I don't know, it's not coming fast enough. Doesn't say what we want it to say. Yeah, it's not as appealing. We want it to say something different. So we go somewhere else and look for that message elsewhere. So when you see that then message, okay, it introduces the priests. These are the ambassadors of God. Then you go to, okay, these are the people who are not ambassadors of God. So don't go to any of these places thinking that you're going to get a message from God. So then where do you go? So it starts out here in verse 15 of where we should be going. The Lord your God will raise up from you a prophet like me. Okay, so think about all these criteria. Like me, like Moshe, from among you. So it's going to be from Israel. And you shall listen to him. So you think about some great criteria for this prophet that's going to be coming. It's going to be someone who is like Moshe. And we think, well, how like him? Is it just going to look like him if we were to know what he looked like? what things would he be like? What are the things that Moshe is known for? Oh. Hearing from God, okay. One who talked with him face to face like a friend. That is one of the key things. Think of Avraham and Moshe. That's one of the things that they are both known for. You know, obviously, versus Avraham with his really trusting God, but that relationship going to being able to talk face to face with him, and that face to face relationship going on for a long period of time through Moshe's life. That talking face to face, that communicating, these are the instructions of God. So the lawgiver. So he's going to be face to face with God, a lawgiver, a leader, one who's going to be leading the people, showing them where they were going. One of the things that Moshe did was taking them from where they were, Mitzrayim, to where they needed to go, to the land. Taking them from their, quote, old life to their new life. That was one thing that Moshe was going to do. Now, the other things that you... Wisdom. Yeah, and you think about the wisdom of Moshe to know what to do in those situations. Well, those key things where you say, like, the wisdom of Moshe, where do you see, like, a lot of those wise things going on? That a lot of that was, you would say, a part of that faith, talking to God face to face, like someone talks to a friend. That interaction back and forth, that you could say the pleading for the people, taking on to himself, saying, hey, you know, punish me, not these people. So these are some great aspects you're thinking of what Moshe represented. His, you could say, if his resume, what would be on it as some great things? Both mediators. So not only talking face to face, but also bringing concern back and forth, bringing judgments back down from God, and also saying, bringing back and saying, hey, please, can you show mercy in this case? Yeah, prophet, a one who speaks for God. So,
as a child.
No, spared from death, saved from death. So you also see the parallels of his early life, and you see that mentioned in the Gospels, where the Gospels touch on these moments drawn from the river, his being saved down in Mitzrayim and being called back out of Mitzrayim. So also being kind of a, in a sense, leader of Israel, but in a sense also kind of a stand-in for Israel, a representing Israel both in himself. So that's kind of part of that, wanting to be a mediator, take on the punishment from God to himself. Because one of the prophecies of the Messiah, and really touches on the life of Moshe, is, out of Mitzrayim I have called my son. So a lot of people would say, well, that only refers to Israel, and of course, called them out from the land. But one of the things that you see in the writings of Yeshayahu or Isaiah is this back and forth picture of Messiah, the suffering servant, the conquering king servant, and the people back and forth. This picture, is it talking about the people of Israel, or is it talking about the servant? And sometimes it looks interchangeable. And is it this role or that role, back and forth? You see that also throughout the life of Moshe. So that when you're talking about this prophet who was to come that was going to be like him, a lot of these aspects that we look to remember in Moshe's life, we should look for in this prophet who was to come. Yes, we have a question down here.
He has multiple functions.
Multiple functions.
I mean, he can also...
multitasker.
Yeah, multitask. You know, it's just like I'm a mom and I'm an aunt, or I could be a sister, or, you know what I mean? Because what I would say to my child, I might not say as an aunt, but I mean his functions as the position that he's in, according to who he's speaking to, right?
And also, one of the things that he's known for, and sometimes you think it's kind of an amazing thing to have this down, is that he's known as one of the most humble people around that has ever lived. That humility there. So we should then look for the one, this prophet who was to come, would be someone of exceptional humility, even surpassing that amount of humility. So when you see the Apostle Paul reflecting upon, you know, Yeshua saying that he didn't think that equality with God was something to be seized or robbed, but he submitted himself to become like a servant, like a man, and then take it all upon himself, take the punishment of Israel upon himself. Yes, we have a comment down here. Just like what Moshe did and run in as a mediator, that's something that we would expect if we were to say, hey, this is going to be someone like Moshe.
Because if you think about it, when the Pharisees and the folks that heard Yeshua speak, they marveled at the fact that he spoke as one of authority.
Yes.
He never really referenced prior rabbis or anything like that. But I think one of the reasons that they might have been so marveled at Yeshua is because they hadn't had prophecy for like 400 years, except for John the Baptist, who was a contemporary of Yeshua. They had not seen a prophet in 400 years. They only could read about prophets like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on. But you also see with Ezekiel and Jeremiah, they don't really, they might quote from scripture, but you never see them reference another earthly authority either. So that was the typical mode of a prophet. The prophet would only quote God's word and what God was speaking to him in the current time. A prophet never quoted from other prophets or rabbis or kings or anything like that. But it had been 400 years since they had seen someone speak like that. And so that should have been a clue that there was somebody special here in their midst, because what Moses said, Moses gave them the template of what a prophet would be like, and the prophet would be like, and they ignored it.
So the word that we get, as talked about with a prophet, is Navi. Navi is the Hebrew word for prophet. And the interesting thing is we look at, well, what a prophet is, and kind of comes down to, well, where does the word come from that we have for prophet? A couple of thoughts on where that word perhaps came from is kind of a very ancient one. Is Nava. And with Hebrew, you got these kind of silent letters off of here, and Aleph versus an Ayin. So Navi is spelled with this Ayin, which is kind of a silent letter at the end of it. Kind of takes whatever vowel is stuck on it. And another silent letter is the Ayin. So this word Nava with an Ayin on the end of it, it means to like bubble up. Something is kind of like a spring bubbling up. So it's thought that one of the first, you might have heard Jacinius as a guy who did one of the first lexicons, really big Hebrew lexicons hundreds of years ago. He was saying this connection, well, because you'll see in Hebrew, especially from ancient Hebrew to kind of, you'd say, perhaps later Hebrew to medieval Hebrew, you'll see these shifts sometimes with the vowels, or especially the silent ones, because it's all just a matter of pronunciation. So how it gets recorded down through time can shift a little bit. Now, from context, we know what the word is actually referring to. So it's not like something gets lost in translation. It's a matter of spelling. You'll see that with the variance between the Masoretic text, which the earliest one of those we have comes from like, what, 800? Yeah, AD 800. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, which date to a couple hundred years BC, at least. So we see some spelling differences in there that from this kind of thing, from a change from an Aleph to an Ayin. But the difference here with this bubbling up, there's thought, well, maybe that's a good a picture of a prophet, of bubbling up So perhaps the bubbling up is that a message from God is given to a prophet and it just bubbles up without him and they just can't help but it's like a fountain. Just like a fountain can't help but expel water out. The message just kind of bubbles up out of a prophet and out it comes. Yes.
Oh, okay, so I was listening to a teacher talking on this morning, and he was talking about prophets, and he'd mentioned that like the Muslims believe that Muhammad was a prophet, and Joseph Smith was a prophet. But if you could set them he didn't say that the Adventists, but I mean the Adventists claim that they have prophets too. But if you could just compare them with Moses before you even see Christ, like just especially the Muslims believe that. If you set this by the Old Testament side by side, it wouldn't be possible, right?
Well, one of those things we'll look at here in just a moment. But yeah, there's tests for a prophet. It's, you know, how do those things compare to the Word of God? So you just basically take all those things and compare them to the words of God.
In their lifetime or just all?
Well, it's that basically, is there a statute of limitations on God's words? If not, then a prophet's word should not have a statute of limitations on it, if they're a true prophet. Yeah. So one picture is with the idea of just bubbling up out of it. Another idea is that from some other, because Hebrew is a part of a group of languages called Semitic languages. We call it like Semites. The picture of typical Semites would be Jews, but there are other Semite groups in there that are similar languages, and Aramaic is a Semitic language, Ugaritic Arabic is also another Semitic language. So it's one of those things, if you transliterate words into like English letters, Roman letters, and you put them side by side, it's like, oh, the spelling is almost nearly identical, even though the characters look different. Oh, Syriac is another Semitic language. The thing about one of these, they call them cognate languages or languages that are similar because of their linguistic derivation from it. So one of these things for words that, like especially ancient Hebrew words, they have no idea what possible meaning they could have. There's a couple of ways you go about it. One of which is to look at perhaps a very ancient translation, one of which is the Septuagint, which was done in, you know, like 1 to 300 BC, which was in ancient Greek. And you look at how those words were translated. What did those, what words did they translate that into? What meaning did the translator have? Or I should say translators. The Septuagint means 70, so traditionally there's 70 translators. What did they find in the meaning of this word? And so then you can go back to where it came from. The other way of going about it is to say, okay, you have a word that is spelled nearly identically with the sounds of the letters and everything. Does it have a kind of a similar meaning given the context of the passage? So often this is done with Ugaritic and Arabic, even though Arabic, a lot of what we have written there is much, much, much later. It's a lot of it's AD stuff, but like the Quran and stuff is written far 600s and such AD, but still you've got those similar words and you still look back and say, well, do you have similar meanings? From Arabic, you have a similar word to Nava, and that means to announce. So you think, well, that kind of fits with a prophet, someone who announces. So you've got a meaning for prophet could be spokesman, someone who announces something. Another one we get from the Torah itself when it talks about Aharon, and at first it mentions there in Exodus that God says, you are going to be my prophet. Then, you know, when Moshe was saying, boy, you know, I'm slow of speech and unready for this, he says, okay, well then I'm going to make you like God to Pharaoh, and I'm going to make Aharon your prophet. And so that case, you see, well, how does that prophet function? So the prophet in that case was Moshe. But the other prophet was Aharon. Well, what role did Aharon say? He was the authorized representative of Moshe. To, you know, the word was coming down to Moshe, and then it would come through Aaron and out. So thus, another way you could say for a prophet is someone who's an authorized representative, an authorized person to bring this forward. And you might say that's a kind of a good picture of where the prophets come from. They are people who are authorized to pass along a message. And a part of the testing of a prophet is the test. Are they actually authorized or not? And that's what this Deuteronomy 18 is getting at, is that you're supposed to figure out if that person is authorized or not. And if they're not authorized, then that is a huge danger to society, especially a huge danger to a society that's just starting to get a beachhead as God's embassy on earth, God's representatives on earth. Another kind of role of the prophet is a part of something that is like a continuing role. Because as the Deuteronomy ends, and you see Moshe is about to die, you'll see this role, his role in there in society was to be continued on in a certain degree. So you would have the roles of the priests, but then you would also have the roles for prophets. And you see, as you get down later into the Chronicles and Kings, you'll see that there was a school of the prophets, a place where prophets were raised up, and kind of doesn't go into a lot of detail into what those schools of the prophets were. You see that they were kind of saved and protected later when you had these tyrant kings that came after them. But these were groups of prophets who would come together and be, interestingly, working in conjunction with the priesthood. So as we look forward on this one who's coming with the messages from God, the things that we look for, and it continues on in Deuteronomy 18, and verses 20 through 22, about the false prophet. So it's like, okay, we got a few tests of a true prophet. And the false prophet mentions here, someone who speaks presumptuously in the Lord's name. In other words, they're not like Aharon. They're not authorized to be saying, God told me this, or thus saith the Lord. Here is the message. They are speaking presumptuously, meaning the big 50-cent word for they are presuming that God is speaking through them. So, presuming that their message is coming forward as God's words. So, that's two pictures of the coin you might look at and say, is this presumption malicious or is it naive? Those are kind of two ways that you can look at that. Naive presumption is that I found this, it seems like it's good, thus God must want me to say it. Malicious presumption is perhaps just as simply as like, this will puff me up, this will make me important. You're looking for your own importance moving forward with this. Both of those types of presumption are incredibly dangerous, because when you think about it, you're saying, thus saith the Lord, and then things are coming out of your mouth. So thus, for those who don't get as far as the, oh, let's check out, test all the words that they say, up to that point when everybody checks out and tests the words that are said, and perhaps you go through, because it says that you're supposed to try them, and if everything bears out, like that court system that was mentioned earlier, factors out, then you are to get rid of them. It was that serious of a situation where you would have some people that were veering things off course. Now you might ask, that seems like incredibly harsh, that if someone is saying, oh, thus says the Lord, but it wasn't really thus says the Lord, now you're killing them? That seems very, maybe someone was just like confused, or maybe they just didn't realize that what they thought they saw wasn't really what actually God was saying. Is that really so dangerous? Another way to look at it is that if you are, say, delivering a truck of something that must get somewhere, and the driver then starts veering for the cliff, will the truck with the stuff that actually has to get there actually get there? No, it won't. So you might say, well, things might come up with a different truck at some other time. You can come up with various scenarios of that. But what we see throughout Israel's history is that these were, this thing that was coming, basically the prophet, was so important that that metaphorical truck, being Israel, had to get to its destination, meaning not just the land, but also being the influence of the world. It had to get there. It absolutely had to get there. So thus, something as dangerous as a driver with an affinity for precipices is hugely dangerous, not just for this people out there in the wilderness, but also for the world at large. Yes. Comment. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was thinking of today. What about these preachers that are on TV and they say, God has spoke to me and has said thus and such? That would be that driver going towards the cliff?
Yeah, it's one of those things that Messiah always said.
God hasn't spoken to me, and yeah. I've been walking with him for 48 years, and I have, you know, I've seen him in a dream, but I've not been awake where he's, you know.
Yeah, because you know, the Lord.
Does that mean I lack faith, or is this guy?
It's one of those things that that.
What? I didn't.
What? one of the things that that we should really keep in mind is what we were talking about earlier about the Levites. If you weren't born a Levite, you know, what, God's mad at you. You're not. You're cursed because you weren't born a Levite. No, you're born something else. You had another role to serve. Paul touches on that about some being born this, some being gifted with that, this gift, that gift. It could be the gift given to him. It's one of those things that we're talking about testing to make sure these things are so. And to also, one of the things I talk about, speaking in the name of a foreign god and that kind of thing. And like we've talked about with the name of God, the name of a foreign god doesn't always just mean that given name that it's known by. It can be reputation, it can be function, etc. So it's one of those things that where if someone is claiming, that's why I was talking about naive and malicious presumption, is that you can just say, oh, this is what God wants me to say. That's why I like what Richard was saying, is like, best to just stick with what the word says. The word says this, you know the limits of what the word is saying and what you are saying. That's why we were just reading last night 2 Corinthians, and it was kind of hilarious because in there Paul's making an argument, going kind of in the argumentum ad absurdum, or arguing from absurdity, and he keeps throwing these little parenthetical things in there. And I'm saying this like a fool. I'm acting like a madman here. And that's really a good thing to kind of differentiate with, like, okay, this is what I think versus this is what God is saying here. And that's one of those things that we just have to just ask for God's mercy, that it's something that is not meant to be something presumptuous. But wow, we should be extremely careful. Extremely careful. Yes.
I was just thinking, I agree that it can be easy to, you know, when you're distinguishing between malicious or naive, it can be easy to kind of focus there on what the motivation is of the person who's doing it. But that's not the weightier issue in that situation. The weightier issue is that whether they're being malicious or not, what they're saying could eventually cost the life of somebody else, the eternal life of somebody else. Somebody else could be led astray. Doesn't matter if the person meant to or not. So in that kind of situation, yeah, if you focus on the motivation of the person and say, oh, well, that punishment seems really harsh, especially if they didn't mean to do that, the punishment is harsh to cause us to think two times and 10 times and 20 times.
To not ever say, thus says the Lord.
To not ever say anything against, because it's not about our motivation. It's about the life of somebody else that we could be costing them.
Yeah, which is extremely important when you're talking about the judicial matters that were mentioned earlier with the two or three witnesses, is that, you know, you have to really verify that things are as they are. There can be some very serious things that happen in society, but, you know, if you only have one witness of things, you have to just really be extremely careful about that. We may get very angry about some things where the guilty go free, but one of those things that we can also look at is it could be mercy if we ourselves get hauled in for something and there is that only one witness. Then we're very thankful that that one witness standard can hold, you know, in society that's gone a little bit away for some crimes where the weight of a particular witness holds up stronger than others. But one of those things that we just have to take into account is that it is also a bit of mercy in there, that things are actually as they are. And so we talk about the standard of witnesses. You see that with Yeshua's trial. You see that with Stephen's trial. Those are two ones that we see really brought into sharp focus of where the Sanhedrin was not operating correctly with the testimony of the witnesses. And something we also saw in this passage is that if someone is accusing you of something and it's not true, look out, because you're going to get the punishment for that. So the perjury thing is not anything to be taken lightly. It's, and when you think of perjury, it's just a big word for legally lying, that is kind of fallen into very, you might say it, we've lost any sort of respect for perjury as being something serious in a number of cases, especially for our, quote, kings or leaders up there. But we should take into account that perjury is extremely serious when it's something that's involving this, the judicial system at any particular level going up. So it doesn't matter what it is. Like I was saying at the outset, you know, stuff flows downhill. So our personal acceptance of lying, either ourselves lying to ourselves, lying to our bosses, lying to our family, lying to anyone around us, that stuff goes uphill. Downhill, I should say. It goes downhill because it really does start with us. So thus, and we talked at the outset with the principle of having a murder. We move on to the sixth commandment. We'll just cover that briefly. Now, one of the things that you had, the sixth commandment, King James Version typically has it as, you know, thou shalt not kill. And some modern versions change that into you shall not murder. So which is it? Is it killing or murder? What is the difference? And, you know, you'll all see differing variations of the definitions of those later on in law books going way, way back. But kind of the very fast and loose definition between those two is killing is just simply ending life. Just simply ending life. Murder being some sort of malice going in there. And you'll see that two specific incidents that are mentioned here in this passage where it's talking about malice and the difference between something that was killing and something that was murder. And it mentions there about the axe and the flying off of your axe handle and killing somebody, and then that being, it's like, oh, wow, that was a killing versus someone lying in wait for murder, because then you start getting into, we talked about malice, having hatred towards, a wicked hatred towards somebody is that old word of malice. You add, start adding various levels of that malice in and what that malice does with your pre-planning. And then you get into varying levels of whether this is murder or killing. But one of the things we should get out of whichever case this is in this passage is that killing is, it is a, you could say it could be a necessary evil, but it is bad. It is the ending of life. And we're talking about the creator of life sometimes has to take life. And then sometimes the things, the forces that are acting against the creator of life do things, you can call them crimes, some vicious activity, and sometimes they have to be stopped. Sometimes they don't want to respond to just stop it. They keep going and going and going. Then you get into the realms of whether you're talking about killing or murder. But that's one of those things that we should look into on all these cases, is that the end of the life of a person is extremely devastating in God's eyes. You know, one of those things you see later on in the prophets where it talks about that he does not delight in the death of the wicked. And you're thinking, wow, what about all that stuff we saw in the Psalms? What about all that stuff that we saw reading this passage here about the deaths of all this stuff? It's like, yeah, the creator, the life giver, sometimes has to end life for this life of everything to move forward into the greater good of what it will eventually be, what you hear on later on the prophets and see later on with Revelation. Now, one of those things we should always remember is that he also said, I'm the one who takes life and I'm the one who can give life. So for the creator, that a life that ends doesn't mean that that life is gone. It just means that that life has ended. One of those things that the message comes through throughout the Torah, this passage and others, is that we should not be extremely flippant in or be nonchalant, be not extremely thoughtful in how we approach the ending of life and that the fact that life has ended. So we see it mentioned here with this case of an unsolved murder. That lies out there, literally, this body lying out there, and you're like, okay, well, what do you do with it? It's not like, oh, well, someone died, you know, put them in the ground and move on with life. It's like the ceremony goes through with this heifer to acknowledge that, wow, there was this death here, and it talks about murder, so it's putting in the category of a intentional killing of somebody. And we have to acknowledge that this death, this taking of life, this murder, is something that has to be atoned for, and uses the picture of the heifer and the flowing water. And it's interesting, the picture of the washing of the hands over and running water over the heifer. What does that make you think of? Well, red heifer should make you think of the red heifer. But you notice one of those things about the about Pilate washing his hands over the case. Now, one of those things that we always have to remember with that is something that God ordained to happen. Just like God lifted up Cyrus, monster, lifted up Nebuchadnezzar, another monster, to actually do, in the long-term scheme of things, good, even though they did a lot of bad in the process, that what Pilate was involved with and what these things were involved with, even what Yehuda Iscariot was involved with, was something that for the greater good of things had to happen. But one of the things Messiah said is, woe to the one through whom that happens. So don't be so flippant that you want to be the one to be the Yehuda, that you want to be the Pilate. Because wow, watch out, about the Kidron Valley? Huh, that's an interesting question. I had not actually experienced it. It was asked the question, the significance of the Kidron Valley for where this heifer was. You're talking about with the Kidron Valley in what context? Oh, a valley. It talks about a valley. Oh, a valley. Huh. Interesting. Well, I'd not really thought of that. Well, perhaps there is something, because, maybe we have some insight here.
Well, the Kidron Valley in particular is always the traditional place to get rid of refuse.
Yes.
Disgusting, gross.
The garbage dump.
Get rid of your garbage dump. That in particular was always the place. When they cleaned the temple up many years later, Hezekiah's time, and Hezekiah's old priest cleaned the whole place up, get all this junk out of here that my father and ancestors have done. They take it all up and they purposely go over to Kidron Valley in the brook and dump it. It's like pollution. That's what they do. They come back. It's the place to get rid of that which is evil and disgusting and grotesque. It is. It's all the blood flows there, everything flows there. All the grotesque stuff and disgusting stuff gets washed away there. Why there? It was chosen. That place has always been chosen. I don't know anything beyond that. That's probably why.
I guess you could say a valley being a good place to know that you're at a low point where water is going to be flowing out. Perhaps it is. But it is a great picture of what Messiah, the prophet, would then end up doing. That the things, if anyone was going to be taking the blame for murder, these ultimate crimes and such, it would be the one that the heifer was representing. And that would be the Messiah coming forward. That this prophet would be one who would actually take these things upon himself. It's in the Kidron Valley. Oh, the nice betrayal, like going to Gethsemane. I'm not quite sure that the geography about heading to the mount and back as to whether you pass through. But yes, when we talk about Gehenna, as it later became associated with the Gehinnom, that the Valley of Hinnom, that place of fire, the burning garbage dump, place of refuse. So as we end out this passage here, one of the things that should really be looking at is when we see the explanation of honor your father and your mother, that's really when you start expanding it out the way Messiah did in the Sermon on the Mount. He was kind of following the prophet like Moses, just like Moses expanded on the Ten Commandments. So Yeshua expanded upon the Ten Commandments and others. One of those things we get there, honor your father and your mother, is a look toward honoring authority. You know, you say starting from the most basic level on up. But it's also a call, as you see the instructions for the king, noting that you're saying to write out the Torah in the presence of the priesthood. So it's not just you have it in your closet or whatever and you're writing it out. This is kind of the interesting thing, writing it out in the presence of the priesthood. I don't know if you ever kind of noted or seen anyone copying a Torah scroll. One of the great scribes, I got a chance to see one. It was quite amazing to see the meticulous approach toward every character being, and you checking and rechecking and stuff like that. You kind of get that picture if the king was at least supposed to copy this thing out with the priesthood watching. That's like, wow, to make sure that is going along. And hopefully, in the process, not just writing it, but perhaps asking questions. Perhaps getting, hopefully there would be some smart priests that would be saying, do you understand what that says? You know, to say, do you get what it is you just wrote there? And so then the king should be listening to the words of God as he writes them and learning them, internalizing them. So that honoring your father and your mother, how far up that father and mother goes in authority, is both something that's in incumbent for respect from the one in a lower position, but it's also for one in a higher position to be worthy of respect and also to respect those under them, that they are treating them well. And as it talks about with Paul, you know, don't incite your children to wrath, you know. So thus, if you have to use punishment and you have to use correction, don't do so wantonly to just make them angry, but make sure that you're doing so with the long-term goal of building them up and not tearing them down. Because that is Israel's history throughout time. Did God just like to hit the smite button? No, he just liked doing these things, these corrections over time, to do what? To build up, build up, build up. So when we sing about building up your walls, that's not just, you know, this is not just a construction project. This is actually training of character. So, an edification, and so that you not only just know these things in your head, but they become a part of you. So that's what Paul was saying, you know, the Torah is a pedagogue, but we never go off and leave any of those lessons behind that we've learned before. We may learn our 2+2 and such, but we never forget it, even if we move well beyond the need to keep getting that rammed into our head by rote. We never, ever leave those lessons behind. And then closing out with the point of taking life is that it should also bring into sharp focus that these things are what God is talking about with these judgments upon nations and such is not something that God is taking lightly either. Because thus you would say, well, all these levels of justice and yet there's no justice for these people. It's one of those things when you see in the end times with the prophecy in Zechariah 14 of all the nations going up. And even it says that even reluctantly Mitzrayim or Egypt goes up. A nation that you see throughout Scripture referred to as being a place of, you know, dragging you down, the old man and such. Still, it's like that mercy keeps getting extended outward. God wants Mitzrayim to come up. Sadly, there is that old life that we have that will just have to be gone. And the old ways of the world, just some people will just not want to be a part of the new way that God works and His kingdom works. That truly, when it talks about His strange or His foreign act that He has to do with the day of the Lord, that foreign act that He has to do, sadly, you could say is probably the most merciful, because for those who do not realize that justice, mercy, and trust are the way that the world should work, it's truly just a sad thing that that has to be done. But in the end, in the grand scope of things, it actually is the most merciful thing to be done. Any last... Oh, yes. Last thought we close out here.
Okay, I think it's interesting how Israel treats the terrorists an eye for an eye. They basically do that to this day.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that's commonly caricatured in common culture about the eye for an eye. So you have a bunch of, as one writer once wrote, it's like, so thus you have everybody going around, you know, eyeless and toothless. That's not what it's talking about, because the phrase eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and then it goes on to talking about, well, if this happens, so then a proportional fine of 20% on top of giving back and this and that. And it's talking about that if you have a life that's taken, that's a life that's taken, and there could be a life that has to be taken otherwise. We say, well, why don't we just go out and whack people today? You know, if they do this and that, we just haul them outside and take them out. Well, number one, we've got the court system that is talked about. Then you also have the two or three witnesses. You don't have those in place, and you have the picture that this is separation from a place where God puts his name is something that's going to happen for a time period. So then where does it go? Does it just go off into nothing? That all this stuff is just left unaddressed. That's
like
the punishment has to fit the crime. But then if you look at, well, who do you punish? Without your total judicial system, where does the punishment go? And that's where you get the picture of the prophet. The prophet like Moses, only more. Because that's what the book of Hebrews is like. People think that it's like, well, so-and-so like Moses, well, how much more Christ? How much more Christ? And they think, well, okay, Moses is passé, now it's all about Christ. It's the how much more is that this is a great example. Well, the prophet is so much better than that. Not that this was bad, that it's obsolete, but this is so much better. And that is the picture you see in Deuteronomy 18, that this prophet, like Moshe, would be coming, but greater than Moshe. Greater in that, for these things that we say cannot be punished, that punishment did not go unpunished. That punishment came down. And it came down on the prophet. The prophet accepted it. The prophet went forward with it. And that being the great mercy of God, is that even though this justice has to be there, that the mercy is also there if we want it. So, let's close with prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us the testimony of all your servants through time. We thank you for the prophets you've given us, the words you've given us. We thank you for the great prophet in your son Yeshua, who's shown us what it's like to be talking with you face to face. It's given us that great opportunity to do so. Father, we thank you for giving us mercy through his blood and for seeing fit that you can transform us into new people going in a new direction. And we thank you for suffering with us for so long when we've been arrogant or totally ignorant of what's going on. Father, we thank you for these things in the name of your son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.